History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The first American president to have his picture taken was John Quincy Adams. Well, he wasn't actually president at the time. The photo was taken in 1843 at his home in Massachusetts, and it was long after Adams had left office. And the photo was taken only 5 years before his death at the age of 80. The photographer was a German-born artist named Philip Haas, who came to the United States but traveled to Paris to learn the art of the daguerreotype. This was a proto-camera. This new technology was the first photographic technique to be made available to the public, and made available in 1839. What's interesting is that John Quincy Adams really didn't like the photo, and he thought that a silhouette image of him would better express his character. At the time, the wealthy and the prominent in society had portraits done of them, and many thought that it better expressed who they were, their inner qualities, than a photograph would, even though today many people consider a photograph to be objectivity. It's literally what you can see. Well, presidents' relationships with photography and their visual image evolves over time, from Lincoln's somber portraits, it's on our currency today, to Lyndon B. Johnson swearing in, to George W. Bush's reactions to learning about the 9/11 attacks. This evolves over time. And photography plays a huge role in how we remember and define American presidents. This is a subject a lot of people don't think about, but it has a lot to do with how we understand American political history. To get into this topic, today I'm talking with Kara Finnegan, who's author of the new book, Photographic Presidents, Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. We look at presidents who basically became president because of photography, like Warren G. Harding, whom many consider to be America's worst president, but was a former journalist and was really good at posing and looking like someone who should be in power, and knew how to make use of and use visual media better than almost anyone at the time. We get into the digital age of the 21st century, where on the one hand, people try to appear very, very relatable, but also control how they're perceived with an iron grip and don't allow people to take unapproved photos. So this was a really interesting discussion. We get into stories that may or may not be true, like did JFK win his debates with Richard Nixon because he did better on camera than Nixon did? And what does it mean to successfully control your image in the 21st century? Do you have to be like Beyonce, where you have a deep connection to your fans, but you're at the same time very aloof and distant and don't allow any unguarded moments to happen? The president and the press, on the one hand, don't like each other, but they need each other, so it's a weird symbiotic relationship. There's a lot to untangle here, and I hope you enjoy this discussion with Kara Finnegan. Kara, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
You look at the history of photography and how it relates to presidents. And when I was looking at the description in your book, there was something that jumped to my mind. About a year ago, I was watching the Peter Jackson documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old. And for listeners who haven't seen it, it's a documentary of World War One that uses footage from World War One, the type of cameras that show everyone moving in fast motion, but it's digitally slowed down, so it mimics real human movements. It's colorized. But what stuck out to me is that every time a camera would go past a group of soldiers or other people, they would all smile when they saw the camera. They acted in a way that you or I wouldn't. I think a lot of people would get camera shy because they're skittish about being before a wide audience. But for those World War I soldiers, for them, I think it was a newfangled technology. Like if you or I saw a hologram and they see it as a curiosity and they're smiling. So what jumped out to me is that this is someone from a century ago who looks at photography in a fundamentally different way than we do in the 21st century. So in your research for your book, were there any moments like that when you could see either from a written account of the subject or the way they appeared on camera that they look at it differently than somebody from today would?
Such a great question. And, you know, the question of how the technology of photography is changing is really a major theme of the book. I got very interested in how presidents were often interacting with technologies of photography when they were new. I'd like to say in some ways that presidents were kind of the canaries in the coal mine in terms of experiencing newer technologies you know, at the same time the public was, or in some cases before the public really had access to them. An example I can pull out is actually from the earliest period of photography, where John Quincy Adams, who in the 1840s is a former president, he's actually a sitting congressman from Massachusetts at the time. John Quincy Adams sees the daguerreotype, the first kind of photography. He sees it for the first time. And he says, I get why people are interested in this. He writes in his diary, they're beautiful, they're wondrous, but he doesn't think they're very good likenesses. And what he says instead is a really good likeness, a faithful representation of a person, is a silhouette, which many of us, if you're of a certain age, maybe you had sat for silhouette portraits, you know, where your teacher in school would trace your profile and then you cut it out in black paper and take it home to your parents and be all proud. That's what he was talking about, the art of the silhouette, which was a popular, a cheap form of portraiture in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And so when I saw that, I just thought, why on earth would John Quincy Adams say that a photograph that just perfectly accurately depicted your face, let's say, was less of a faithful representation than a silhouette? And so that got me thinking about, okay, what is it that I would need to understand about John Quincy Adams's time and his experience of visual arts in order for that to make sense? And that's when I started to learn a little bit more about the silhouette. And I learned that silhouettes could actually be quite elaborate. And in fact, were often very faithful representations, for example, of the accurate profile of a person, et cetera. It turned out that John Quincy Adams didn't like photography because he actually thought it was too faithful to the person. It maybe didn't show you in the light that you always wanted to be in. You know, I think about us using the Zoom filters to, you know, get rid of some of those wrinkles we're all experiencing looking back at us from the Zoom cameras. But to me, that was a really interesting moment where I really thought, okay, I need to put myself into the headspace of these folks who are not only looking at different things than I am, but they're just seeing differently also.
Yeah, I would like to take a moment to really unpack that before we, you know, kick off the whole history of photography and technology and everything. For somebody back then, I wonder what he would think is the most faithful reproduction, maybe portraiture, since that goes back to George Washington and even up to today, when it's a long since sort of a defunct technology. Did they somehow think that portraiture is more accurate because it goes through the prism of a talented artist and it gets the je ne sais quoi of the subject, and whereas a photograph is not that, even though you or I would say, no, a photograph is objectivity in front of us. On the internet, people will throw down the phrase, pics or it didn't happen, that you need photographic evidence of something or you're just throwing out accusations. So could you describe what's going through the mind of John Quincy Adams to think, this isn't the best, I need something better?
Portraiture in that period, so when photography is invented, when it comes to the United States, incidentally, as an open source technology, which I always think is kind of fun and interesting to point out, it's 1839. And at that point, portraiture really is the way to communicate, not just the way a person looks, but as you said, the je ne sais quoi, the character, the moral character, in fact, of a person. So for an elite person, like John Quincy Adams, who, you know, is a child of the revolution. He's the son of a president. He's a former president of himself. He is actually one of the most visually represented people of his age, even before photography comes along. So he has a pretty ingrained and sophisticated understanding of portraiture as being about preserving the, not just the likeness, but the character of a person, as he liked to say, for the next age. So for him and for people like him, right, who are at the highest kind of elitist parts of the nation, it's also about your legacy and what you want people to see when they look back at you. And it's also, again, portraiture isn't something that the average person on the street without a lot of income can get for themselves. So there's also a class dimension as well. You could certainly purchase miniature portraits and other kinds of images, those cheap silhouettes I mentioned, for example. But a portrait of the kind that Adams would have appreciated, that really depicts the person as the person wanted to be remembered. That's a pretty elite status kind of art.
Well, I think it's funny that, so you mentioned he's one of the most depicted people of the time. Now, I'm not very familiar with John Quincy Adams, how he appears, but I know a lot about John Adams because Thomas Jefferson's hatchet men most famously took him down. I've mentioned this quote a lot on this podcast that they said, "He has neither the firmness of a man nor the gentleness of a woman, but is hermaphroditic in form." They were saying that John Adams was really, really ugly. Now, John Quincy Adams, of sharing his father's DNA, probably isn't ready to walk the runway, so not the most handsome man. But if he's the most depicted, I suppose that's something in favor of antebellum America, that representation of a person wasn't for their physical beauty, but maybe it was their prestige or the values that they imbibe. Or what did it mean to represent somebody at a time when John Quincy Adams would have been the most visually represented person?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And, you know, if we had a kind of the presidential fight club of handsomeness, right, we might, and, you know, probably Adams would not score very highly. We could have a fun conversation about that. But yeah, so Adams, one of the things I found really interesting is I started looking at these earliest moments in the history of photography, and particularly reading Adams's diary, which was incredibly fascinating for a variety of reasons. Artists came after these elite figures like Adams. So Adams didn't, you know, sit around and go, "Oh gosh, I would like another great portrait of me painted," right? Or, "I would like someone to sculpt a bust of me." It was the opposite, that these visual arts and artists needed not only patrons, right, so that they could, you know, support themselves, but they needed elite patrons so that they could display the quality of their work and the significance of their work to other potential patrons and sitters. So in the earliest period of photography, one of the things I thought was really interesting was that photographers, the daguerreotypists, for example, in Boston, in the case of Adams, and also in Washington, D.C., would send a note and say, "Please come and sit for me," right? And then if you could get an elite person, a former president certainly, to come and sit for you, well, then you could display their portrait and then other people could see it and then they might want their portraits too. So there's a kind of marketing value that I think, you know, makes sense, but it's not necessarily something I thought a lot about until I started doing the research. And then, you know, in addition, it really is that sense of preserving faces and the characters of those faces for history. So in the period when the daguerreotype first appears in, you know, in as the 1840s move along, the Revolutionary War era generation is dying out. And photography suddenly becomes this kind of marvelous, urgent way to literally capture the real faces of these folks before they pass away. So there's this kind of odd scramble at one point for a photograph of Andrew Jackson, and people sort of stake out his house down in Tennessee, in fact, and eventually are able to go in and photograph him at the very end of his life. So there's this real, I think, connection to history, and all of the visual arts, particularly portraiture, of all kinds, not just photography, are participating in that, you know, let's preserve these American figures, these founders of the Republic for history. But photography then kind of ups the ante because then we can see how they really looked.
Right. So once we move on and we get into the middle of the 19th century, we start to have photographs of sitting presidents. So Abraham Lincoln, his photograph, what we have on our currency comes from that photo. As oil portraiture is still being done, now we have photographs. And one point you make in your book is that presidential photographs are representations of leaders who symbolize the nation, spark public debate on these values and their implications. What does that mean as photographs of sitting presidents start to become commonplace in the 19th century?
I think there's a couple of ways to think about it. One is that it becomes clear that photographs become a way for people to see their president in a different way. most Americans are not going to ever come face to face with the president of the United States. And the photograph, or, you know, the engravings of photographs before you could print actual photographs in newspapers and magazines, become a way of getting to know the president. So even if you couldn't see a photograph, knowing that an engraving was based on a photograph gave it a kind of veracity and realism that a sketch or a painted portrait wouldn't have. So it's reducing the distance, I think, between presidents and the people in interesting ways that certainly for presidents become more problematic as we move on toward the later 19th and early 20th century, when cameras get smaller and people can sort of photograph you without you noticing or posing. And then that raises a whole host of questions about privacy and gaffes and things like that. But I really think ultimately it's that sense of being able to see your president as a person, you know, a real life person walking around in the world is pretty significant for the public.
Yeah, I wonder about that with photography, because at the late 19th, early 20th century, there are moments when it seems older institutions haven't caught up with the modern world. I think of John Rockefeller and Standard Oil. They are facing scandals and they issue no comment whatsoever with, and I can't remember the specific one coming to my mind. I don't know if it's the miner strike or another one, but I read a biography of him and the book notes that they had no public relations team whatsoever to handle a crisis. They simply issued no comment, which that's shocking. A massive corporation today would have an army of PR agents to quash down any negative story. And it's sort of like the business practices of old hadn't caught up with the media of the day. Were there any things like that that happened where presidents were unguarded? They simply didn't understand the new media ecosystem that was coming up around them. And they engaged in activities that left them exposed in a way that they realized after, I don't know, pictures appeared or other things that they couldn't go about the old ways anymore.
At these moments where the portable camera emerges as a thing that everyone can own a camera, everyone can make their own pictures. You can walk around in the street and take pictures of people in public. There is a kind of surprise and anxiety about these so-called camera fiends, who you could think of them maybe in a way as a kind of late 19th, early 20th century precursor of the paparazzi. But the idea that the camera fiends were going to kind of violate the norms of the decorum that presidents deserve. So in general, I would say that there are moments where presidents are surprised, frustrated, angry that their very presidentialness, if you will, is being violated by these cameras popping up out of nowhere. So one example I talk about in the book is not long after Theodore Roosevelt becomes president, when William McKinley is assassinated, he is leaving church. And a newspaper reported this as a so-called young man, a camera fiend, leveled his Kodak at the president and was getting ready to take the shot. And a police officer with Roosevelt was sort of given the sign, you know, to go detain this kid, you know, make him put his camera down. And Roosevelt reportedly walked right up to him and said in his face, you know, it is a terrible thing to photograph a man as he leaves the church. So there's this sense of presidents having anxiety about losing control of when and where their image is circulated. Roosevelt himself was extremely skilled at public relations. And in fact, he would schedule photo ops outside of his own church all the time and come out and with his family and talk to people, et cetera. So it's not so much the idea that I think presidents, you know, were coming to understand, especially in the early 20th century, they were really coming to understand public relations from their perspective, but they were not necessarily thrilled with the idea that they were going to lose control over the image. And that comes to a head, I think, even more so in the 1930s, when we have the rise of the so-called Candid camera, which is essentially the 35 millimeter camera that, you know, a lot of us who were born in the late 20th century grew up with as the family camera. You put rolls of film in it, you take pictures. But it was a revolutionary instrument because you could make photographs in low light, you could take a lot of shots at once. And when amateur and professional photographers started using these cameras to photograph presidents, presidents were, again, felt a kind of escalation of that threat of losing control, not knowing who was taking a picture of them or where. You know, you didn't even need a flash for these cameras. You could photograph a president indoors without them necessarily being aware. And Herbert Hoover is actually a really interesting figure in this regard. You know, I joke that, you know, I have not selected the most handsome presidents to discuss in this book, because perhaps not surprisingly, sometimes the most interesting things happen in terms of presidents and the technologies of photography with different presidents. So Hoover didn't really understand how he could exploit this new way of photographing, this more candid way of photographing. And there was a German photographer, very famous photographer named Eric Salomon, who in the late 1920s and early 1930s gained fame in Europe for photographing political figures, diplomats. He would go to these diplomatic conferences and either sneak in or kind of pretend that he had been invited. But all the diplomats came to know him, and they really liked him because they saw his very candid photos of, you know, diplomats sitting around a table hashing out the New World Order in Europe. They saw these photos as, oh, this is someone who's really showing how we do the work and is showing how committed we are and how interesting and important we are. And so those folks kind of learned to avoid the camera, and they learned to let those candid cameras take these seemingly unposed pictures of them.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Salomon comes to Washington, D.C. in 1931, and he doesn't quite get the memo on this. And so Salomon comes and tries to photograph him with Pierre Laval from France, and Laval totally gets it. And when you look at the photographs, they're really almost funny, because Laval is trying to be in conversation with Hoover while this photographer is shooting that. And Hoover just keeps staring at the camera. It's like, he doesn't get it. He doesn't want to participate, you know, in this rhetoric of the candid camera. So there are moments like that. But to me, what is the most striking, especially as we move into the 20th century, is this tension between control and interactivity. You know, you want to control, if you're the president, you want to control your image. But at the same time, you know that you want to give the public something more candid, something more human, because that's what they want. And also that probably most of the time helps you too.
Right. I mean, that's the funny thing today in the 21st century of appearing relatable and human and down to earth on social media, yet locking down your public image and exerting more control than a authoritarian dictator. But one thing real quick in the 20th century before we jump ahead, because I'm talking with a communications professor, I would be remiss if I didn't get into the world of Warren G. Harding. So on this podcast, I've spent way more time on Warren G. Harding than anyone ever should have, because a listener asked me to do an episode about, was there any foul play at his death? So I dove into the world of Warren G. Harding, and believe it or not, there are Warren G. Harding fans out there and apologists and people who say, oh, he's not the worst president. He was mediocre. He's in the bottom 30% of presidents. He's not the worst. So that's damning with faint praise. But so Warren G. Harding, many historians consider him America's worst president. He was the Republican nominee only because at the convention, he was finally nominated on the 10th ballot as the consensus choice, as the lowest common denominator, but he was a former journalist. And one of the ways that he was praised is that he looks statuesque. He looks like a Roman politician. He has this old world gravitas about him. So I wonder, was he someone who, due to his media background, maybe he knew how to use the visual arts, and he was very popular as a president at the time as well, so make the most use of them, even though many people thought that he was simply an empty suit.
Yeah, Harding comes at this time when there's kind of this, I think, nice marriage of technology and the willing president. In other words, Harding, you know, was a newspaper man. He knew how they fought. He knew how to get coverage. They ran a pretty sophisticated media campaign. And then when he became president, you know, a lot of what I found in my research was that by the 1920s, it's like, you got to show up for the newsreel photographers and you got to show up for the still photographers. And Harding was just game. He would bring his dog, you know, who doesn't love a presidential dog? He would pose for photographers. Seemed to have that kind of, dare I say it, kind of Reagan-esque movie star, you know, sort of faux informality, right? That was just enough to keep things friendly and comfortable with the photographers. Calvin Coolidge was actually pretty equally game, but got himself into some funky situations. He liked to dress up. So he liked to put on cowboy chaps. He very famously was photographed in a Native American headdress and ridiculed and made a certain amount of fun of because of that. So the kind of the rise of the photo op, the photo op space becomes really fraught, and it still continues to be fraught today for sure for presidents. But the 20s are really that moment where so much of presidential communication is becoming visual. You don't quite have radio yet, but you've got film, you've got newsreels really kicking in. And then you've got photography, which by that point, you know, you've got multi-page what they called rotogravure sections in the Sunday paper. So you'd have a whole section of your Sunday paper that would just be news, interest, entertainment, photographs. So that's a lot of space to fill. And presidents were a really prime target for that space.
I want to get to maybe a best of and a worst of list when it talks about presidents and media. Who you think had the most mastery and who do you think was simply out of his depth? But one thing I want to address, we were talking about most photogenic, handsomest presidents earlier with John Quincy Adams not being that. If you were to force people to put together a quick list, they would probably put JFK at the top of that list of being most photogenic. And this isn't quite the issue of photography, but when we talk about the president and media, one of the most famous incidents that's often referred is the 1960 presidential debate between Nixon and JFK, where it was televised. Nixon looked down at his notes. He seemed a bit frumpy, whereas JFK looked right at the camera. He commanded a presence. And I don't know if this is true or apocryphal, but those who listened to radio said Nixon won. Those who watched television said JFK won. Now, it's one of those stories that's passed around much. I don't know enough about it to say if it's true or not. Do you know more about that incident? And what does that say about the image of a president by the middle of the 20th century?
Yeah, I think folks in my field have largely debunked that main piece of data about doing better on radio versus television. And I think the question there actually connects to how polls were taken, right? So it's tied almost to a broader set of questions than just the visual look. To me, what's interesting about that story is not necessarily what's true or false, but why we need certain parts of it to be true, or what it means we want certain parts of it to be true. So what is our desire? And I think our desire is to have, I guess, kind of have it two ways. We want to have an explanation where the handsome photogenic person wins, but we also want to be able to make a claim that maybe the less handsome, less photogenic person was actually the more substantial and the better arguer, right? So it sort of plays both ends against the middle, if you will, in that case, that to, you know, the legend that Nixon did better on radio means that his voice mattered, that means that his arguments and that the content and substance, right, of what he said mattered. Whereas Kennedy, you know, in that story's narrative, you know, would have been just more superficial and kind of not digging into specifics and arguments and whatnot. And then, you know, the reverse is true. So it's a way to both cast the better visual figure as better, but also superficial, right? And that's a charge that presidents have to deal with all the time in these contexts, that to care about your visual environment, to care about the way you look, to care about your image in a literal visual sense, is to somehow mean you're less substantial of a leader. So that story to me really is emblematic of kind of what is it that we want from our presidents and what is it that we need their pictures to do for us.
Interesting. So do you think that people want the best of both worlds, where they're so brilliant that they don't need the visual medium to sell it? It's only the strength of their ideas and that can win. But at the same time, they also have a commanding gravitas. Do you think that's what people want, or something else?
I think it is. I think you want both of those things. And, you know, in a kind of funny way, this takes us back to someone like John Quincy Adams, right? Who wants to be able to visually present himself in a particular way that is tied to his beliefs about his leaderly qualities and his beliefs about what a moral, good character person looks like, right? And I think we still seek that out, even though the technologies are changing.
Before getting into the 21st century or digital technologies, when this relationship becomes very different, I'm curious, from your vantage point, who do you think was the best president when it came to dealing with visual media and the worst president?
Really challenging. The question of the worst is a really challenging question.
Right, right.
I think partly because I didn't necessarily work through every single president. I really focused on these moments where photography is changing. So with that caveat, I would put Hoover pretty far down on my list as close to the worst for the reasons that I said, which is the norms of the medium were asking him to do things that he wouldn't or couldn't do. And so if we take that as our criterion, that the president needs to meet the moment of the medium, then we can look, I think, at a few figures as really key. I think one of them is Abraham Lincoln, who is someone who is deeply interested in his own visual image. And he very clearly understands that photography in particular is a technology that benefits him. And he's someone who is, you know, routinely photographed, especially after he becomes president. And we still, we see his photographs on our money every day. And we also, we know what Lincoln looked like. And we also believe that what he looked like tells us something about his personal character. And Lincoln skillfully cultivated that. And then I think in a more recent context, the other figure really is Barack Obama, that the Obama White House really was a place where that moment met the changes in the medium of photography. And they essentially set the norms for subsequent presidents in terms of digital visual engagement.
And fun fact, I don't know if this is true or not, but I read a post about Lincoln that he often hid his hands in photography. He had most likely had Marfan syndrome, which leads to very, very long limbs and being thin like Lincoln was, but also typically disproportionately large hands. So he typically put them as pockets or other things to not, you know, have anything seem strange or disproportionate. and that's interesting. You mentioned with Hoover, someone who just wasn't up to the moment. And I can't think of examples in America, but I lived for many years in Turkey, and there's huge swaths of the political class there that are very elderly. And it's a symptom of the oligarchy nature of their political system. So you'll have men in their 70s or 80s who are trying to pose for selfies and be relatable to the youth. And it's painful in any way you could possibly imagine. It is, it makes me uncomfortable just thinking about it. So, all right. So before the selfie era and digital technology, are there any other main inflection points that you think are worth mentioning as we go through this narrative of presidents and visual technology?
Key to point out that parallel to this development of photography across the 20th century. So the 35 millimeter camera becomes basically the kind of standard camera for everybody, the standard news camera for journalists as well. And so there's kind of two parallel developments, I think, that happen at the end of the 20th century that are worth mentioning just briefly. One is the rise of the role of the official White House photographer. There are a number of different places where you can pin the first official White House photographer. The history is fuzzy because the military would assign people photographers to cover the White House. And so there were photographers who worked full-time at the White House who were not necessarily White House photographers in the way that we think of them today, with people like Pete Souza or David Hume Kennerly, who very skillfully photographed for Gerald Ford. But the rise of that role is really important because you get an institutionalization really starting in earnest with Lyndon Johnson and then moving up to the present day. You get an institutionalization of someone whose job it is to picture the president. Like, that is their job. So that's an important thing that we need to consider. And the second is just what I would call the perennial push-pull between presidents and the press. So White House photographers always want more visual access to the president. The president is often not willing to give them more visual access. And so over time, you get these moments where particularly what we would now think of as the mainstream media, the Beltway folks who are ensconced in the White House and their job is to cover the president, are, both insiders and outsiders, and everyone is struggling with that relationship. Presidents want to control it, the media want to control it, and there's this constant tension that really never goes away.
So I wonder now, in the 21st century, having a successful media strategy, what does that mean with how we understand a president? And I'll try to explain what I'm thinking of this question here. So I'm trying to think of who is a celebrity who has the most powerful, best control over their image. Listeners, I'm not cool on contemporary music. I don't listen to Beyonce. I don't really listen to any contemporary music, but I think of her as a celebrity who, sort of like the head of the CIA, has complete dominance, where on the one hand, she can appear relatable, probably has the strongest connection to fans of anyone. There was a great Saturday Night Live skit where Andrew Garfield was host, and the whole point was he mentions to friends that he doesn't like Beyonce's music, and then there's an assassin kill squad coming after him the entire rest of it. But the point is that, like, there's no one who has maybe a more devoted fan base. So on the one hand, she's cultivated an intense sense that her fans know her on a personal level. Taylor Swift, other people, you can mention that too. But she's also incredibly remote and incredibly private. Her and Jay-Z are behind the scenes power brokers, have met with the Obamas, operate on high levels. But so there's incredible power, but what is presented is a friendly person that you know, even though you really don't know them. So is that success in the 21st century? And what does that mean for us if that is success for our political class?
That's such a great question. And it points to the place we're at with digital culture right now, which is that figures like Beyonce, figures like presidents, have the ability to reach their base, their fan base, their political base, however you want to define it, without needing to use all of the levers of traditional media that they used to have to use. So Beyonce can release a secret album that she's been recording at home during the pandemic, right, to her fans. And the entire system is just structured from within her own universe, right? She doesn't need to rely on anybody else because she has her own mechanism. She's essentially her own media distribution channel. And presidents are becoming much the same way. And that's really, I think, what happened with the Obama era, where they really decided that they were as one of their communications folks that I quote in the book said, we can't not play in that space, right? Like, this is where culture's heading. This is where politics are heading. We need to be there. And so we're gonna be as good at it as we can. And yeah, I mean, to think about, like, what does that mean for success? Does that mean that you, does that ultimate control equal success? It's hard to say. And you know, digital culture often has the last laugh, doesn't it? So we live in a world of memes and other viral, playful and sometimes not so playful things. And so even if, you know, a president like Obama or, another, hugely popular kind of celebrity figure can really lock it down and become this kind of powerful one-way, communication network, if you will. Once it's out there, people can do whatever they want with it. Like, that really still, for the most part, particularly for presidents, and their images are in the public domain, if they're made by the White House, there's not a lot of control there. But to the extent that that interactivity, that that engagement with the fans or with the political base or with the public helps you, that's not bad either, right? So, you know, it can also be very harmful, of course. But there's, again, this kind of tension between control and interactivity that I find really interesting. And the public will kind of always try to step in and have their say. And that's really fascinating, too, in the context of thinking through the history of visual media.
Well, I mean, there's a lot more stories to get into here in much, much greater depth in your book. But before we sign off, are there any other points that you hope listeners and readers can get from this, of understanding this push and pull between presidents and photography and how they're represented visually?
I think there's a couple of things I would say. The first is that, you know, we think we live in an era of new media, but sometimes we fail to recognize that all old media were once new media. So when we think about, for example, how presidents interact with new media, we need to recognize again that they're that kind of canary in the coal mine figure, that they often help us understand how to navigate between the old and the new, whether they do it well or whether they do it poorly. So we can learn a lot about the history of media, I think, by studying it through the lens of the presidency, because presidents are so deeply implicated, for example, in the history of photography. And then I would say, I think the second thing that I would say as a kind of bigger picture theme is, you know, we often, it's pretty easy to understand that presidents need visual media. Presidents needed photography, you know, to build their political image, to circulate their ideas and their arguments and all of that. But it's also the case that photography and other visual media have always needed presidents, right? They need them to be subjects. They need to build their own importance as public arts. Photography needed presidents so that it could demonstrate its value as a way to document history. And so I think to the extent that we recognize that presidents and photography and these other visual media really have grown up together, we can understand both more deeply.
Right, a symbiosis that won't end. And for those who read your book, that means that if nothing else, you can look at the portrait of a president on our currency and be able to mention things about it that you would have never known otherwise, in addition to many other things they would get. So the name of the book is Photographic Presidents, Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. Kara, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.